Hello, you're listening to Generous Questions with me, Joe Morrison. This is a podcast about philosophy, and it's made at Queen's University in Belfast. This episode is with Dr. Claire Moriarty, a researcher at Trinity College Dublin. She's an expert on George Berkeley's philosophy of mathematics. We spoke in October 2019 when Claire was visiting Queen's Belfast to give a research seminar about Berkeley's views on mathematics. And she also ran a masterclass for our undergraduate students on philosophers and mathematics in the 17th century. Our conversation covers a load of things. We chat about what it's like to have precarious employment in universities, about whether Berkeley was a professional troll, about how it feels to work on a topic that overlaps between several disciplines at once, and yes, about Berkeley's sometimes far-out views about all sorts of things. For context, and if it helps, Berkeley was an Irish philosopher and bishop who wrote a load of provocative things in the 1700s. He's famous for maintaining a position that we call idealism, which says that the only things that exist are minds and mental events. That's all there is, minds and mental events. So, for example, physical things like coconuts or trampolines or jellyfish exist only insofar as they're being perceived by a mind. It's as though there aren't really any coconuts or trampolines independently of us at all. Instead, they're all just sort of composed out of bundles of our ideas. But while this is the normal story that we tell about what Berkeley thinks about everyday objects in the external world, I really didn't know much about Berkeley's philosophy of mathematics before talking with Claire. I suppose one way to think about it is this, that if, like Berkeley, you think that for something to exist, it has to be perceived by a mind, then there'll be some things that mathematicians talk about, which Berkeley and idealists are going to balk at. For example, mathematical work in calculus deals with infinitesimals, and one of the things that we know about infinitesimals is that they're really hard for us humans to think about, or to imagine, or to conceive of. But if Berkeley is right, and that for something to exist, it has to be perceived by a mind, then since we can't perceive infinitesimals, even in our imaginations, I guess he's going to want to say that they don't exist. And the upshot would mean that Berkeley would also think that the whole of calculus is concerned with something that doesn't really exist. And as it happens, that's precisely what he did think. In his book, The Analyst, Berkeley refers to Isaac Newton's infinitesimal calculus as dealing with the ghosts of departed quantities. The challenge that Berkeley created for himself by being an idealist is that he then needed to be able to give mathematics and the newly invented calculus that was really successful a more secure foundation in the kinds of qualities that our minds can perceive. That was a bit of a quick summary, and I certainly don't think I've done justice to the ideas here, but hopefully that's a useful bit of stage setting for the following conversation with Claire. Claire's written some excellent stuff about this topic, and I've put together a list of useful links on the show's website. Go to generousquestions.co.uk to find out more. I've also included some links there to some of the other things that we talk about, and as usual, you're welcome to get in touch with me and ask any follow-up questions you have. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Joe Morrison, and you can also get in touch with me through the show's website. Claire has a very active and enjoyable presence on Twitter. You can find her there at Quite Claire. That's all one word, at Quite, C-L-A-R-E. Okay, now let's start the episode. You're listening to Generous Questions.
My name is Claire Moriarty, and my current academic job is I'm a Government of Ireland postdoctoral fellow at Trinity College in Dublin, where I'm doing 2 years of research on a variety of topics, mostly to do with either Berkeley or calculus.
Great. How long? So you've only just recently got back to Dublin, but you were there before.
Yeah.
Right, and you were at UCD.
Yeah. So the year or two before this, I've been over and back between jobs in King's, the Forum for Philosophy at LSE, and then UCD. So I've been sort of doing the adjunct thing, kind of following and the money.
But how does that strike you? I mean, it strikes me as crazy that we have people that, I mean, I did it as well. So I think I had 3-4 permanent jobs, a period where I was unemployed, trying to make sense of it. I mean, do you feel like you've started to make sense of it? I mean, you've got a government postdoc now for 2 years. right, in Trinity, but like, so it's working, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I want to feel sorry for myself because I did do, I mean, some really grotty part-time jobs while I was doing that to make it possible to be doing work that's pretty badly paid in philosophy. Yeah. But on the other hand, I'm so fortunate in the sense that like there are people I can live with in, I mean, in Dublin, I've got friends who live here and from here.
I mean, they're expensive cities, right? London and Dublin. It's hard to see that you could have picked other places in these islands which would be more expensive, but
but there is more work at least here, so I mean, I think and especially with the kind of increase of the teaching share being done by adjuncts, there often is just work going that isn't.
So have you been doing a lot of teaching in the last sort of 4 or 5 years then?
I mean, during the PhD, I only finished the PhD 2 years ago, so I was teaching pretty furiously during the PhD at King's where I was doing it, and then afterwards, and then I combined that with this fellowship for public philosophy I have at the Forum. And then lots of other strange bits and bobs of jobs, including selling and valuating antique books. Yeah, I worked for the Justice for Magdalens Foundation as well. So the research group that does work for the Magdalen women, and, you know, done various projects or editing bits and pieces.
Like, and those are like small bits of paid work with like a quite fast turnaround or something. So essentially you're hustling the way that freelance operators are in other parts of like the economy. So the way that journalists now tend not to have like desk jobs, rather they'll just be pitching and trying to find out who's got work that they can do. I mean, is that how it feels like?
Yeah, and like it also feels like seasonal in the way other bit jobs are as well. Huh. So, you know, when the summer comes and there's no longer, you know, university coursework to be taught, it definitely is the case that you, you know, I know friends who've started up summer schools for tourists and, you know, kids and stuff. Wow. I mostly did sort of work in the bookshop then, or, you know, bits of editing work for people's academic stuff. But yeah, you do kind of have to be balancing the work that stays okay on your CV, like the teaching work, with stuff that you can constantly just be doing when you need to top up your maintenance.
And in that process, have you been applying for jobs the whole time? Were you looking for?
Not really. So, I mean, I really knew this was really the postdoc I wanted. So I wanted to come back to Dublin. I really wanted to work on Berkeley in Trinity. So this really is a bit of a dream come true. So I did, I have to admit, like I'm one of those lucky people who did sort of hit on it first time with a proper serious job application. But I have no illusions about the likelihood of that continuing in my
It's a funny, it's definitely an odd one, isn't it? That, like, so I've noticed over, I've got a little folder in one of my laptops that's just all the jobs I've applied for over the years, because I think my approach was just completely different. So I was thinking like, okay, I want to get a job. I know I'm going to have to move for it anyway. I've got to keep working on these papers, but I've got to keep putting myself out there. And then over the, I think by the time I'd had like 2 or 3 jobs, I realized that I'd applied for so many jobs, and I worked out the number of hours it must have taken me to do that. And it was just a huge amount. I think one of the jobs I had was at Aberdeen, where they said they would pay me for 200 hours of teaching. So instead of saying like a semester's worth of teaching, they just sort of said it's precisely this number of hours. And I definitely by that point spent more than 200 hours applying for jobs. And you just think the idea that these two are going to somehow always stay neck and neck, you know, the amount of work I get and the amount of time I spend trying to get the work.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it feels like it could be better managed as well.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I know applying for even smaller bits of jobs or grants for various sort of research or archive trips, very often what's requested is, you know, something that needs to be repackaged into a different kind of arbitrary number of words. Mm-hmm. And I know for people who've done the really big slews of, you know, tenure track job applications and that kind of thing, you're constantly having to switch a certain bulk of material that is, say, naturally 2000 between 500 words, 750, 3000, you know.
And then also sort of spin it slightly differently because they maybe have an interdisciplinary focus, so you need to bring that back in, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and mention names and these kind of things where, you know, I mean, I think it would all benefit us all if it was a slightly more honest process where, you know, you admit that your application would be as appropriate for the next door neighbor university as well.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, so I'm constantly advising people right now who are applying for PhDs and master's students here at Queen's, and then one of the things I'm saying is, look, you're writing a proposal for work you haven't really done yet, so it's obviously the person who's reading it knows that. It's kind of, it's a big conceit that we're all part of, that we know that you haven't done the work, we know that you're not sure that it's going to work out that way, but you should propose to do it anyway because that shows that you're in the game.
And as though it's obviously going to change the world as well. I mean, it's quite hard to have to do that.
It's super important, and it has to be at this institution, which you're then going to change that word as soon as you apply it somewhere else. Yeah.
And it was lucky for me with this application that I was able to say, look, I'm doing a lot of work that is very historiographical kind of on Berkeley, and that is related to a certain kind of academic culture, Irish Enlightenment, they're calling it these days, that's happening in Dublin in that period. So it was easier to make that case than it would have been to make the case to the British Academy, which I would have been trying to do.
You'd be asking them for money so that you could go to Dublin.
Or wherever I was allowed, that was really where it needed to be anyway.
So you arrived in Dublin recently, back in Dublin, and you've dived into the archives. You've gone and dug out first editions of your handwritten spidery notes written by Berkeley.
Been working on some really nice texts. So if you're looking at these kind of archival manuscripts, you get to do a really fun thing, which is walk into the Long Room, which is the really big, famous sort of Book of Kells housing library in Trinity, and go against every sign, holding your kind of lanyard, and then remove a velvet curtain to the kind of gasping eyes of all of the tourists, and then slip down a back corridor.
You're like a celebrity then.
Yeah it is. Great. I mean,
do you have to wear those white gloves that
you have to lock everything in a locker. So other than a pencil or a laptop, you can't really bring anything liquids or anything near them. And then they sit them on a nice cushion for you, and they have the sort of weighted beads that mean that you can... Basically, you're trying to touch things as little as possible.
Wow, cool.
So the few bits I've been working on have
you'd
been...
You'd have to wear a face mask or whatever, it's none of that.
I don't think so. I don't know. I wonder how physically dirty you'd have to be for them to be I don't know.
Right, okay.
But I've been working on... So there's a biography of Berkeley made after he died by a guy called Stock, and Trinity have a copy of it that has a load of annotations by Berkeley's wife correcting various mistakes and things. There's one really nice example where the biographer has said that Berkeley thought this guy Steele, who was a famous publisher at the time, was a great wit and scholar, and then she, in her notes, she's like, the Bishop of Cloyne had a lot of time for this guy and thought he was a great wit and fun in conversation, but not underline a great scholar. So it's just it's pretty cold
across the ages. Is there a particular thing you're going looking for, stuff that you probably know is in there, right?
Well, I have found one thing that I didn't know was in there that is really interesting that I'm looking at the moment, but I won't get the final access to till Friday, so it's very hot off the press.
Good, yeah.
And I'll talk about it later in the talk. But Oliver Byrne, who is the mathematician who did the coloured Euclid in the mid 19th century, so the I think it's the first six books of Euclid, and they're coloured in a way that kind of helps you understand certain geometric relations that are being expressed in the...
These are great teaching tools. That's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. The guy had an absolutely mad life as well.
Oliver Byrne did, right?
Okay. Yeah, he seems to have sent a lot... he was in debtor's jail in London. He sent all these weird applications to the Literary Fund in London, including one where he seemed to have blown his hands off by bomb making and just all sorts of really interesting... I think he'd been circulating a Freedom for Ireland document around America that was trying to train people in knife fighting and small gun.
This is how
combat.
We'll do it. This is how we'll do it, guys. Well,
yeah, but so he had been
he
the
was
last
a mathematician
work,
who was
he was a mathematician who,
an army.
other than trying to blow things up, was also trying to blow up certain conceptions of mathematics. Mm-hmm. He was working on this thing at the end, I think, called a trinal calculus, which I don't understand why he used the word trinal. Maybe somebody listening would. Mm. But I think it also means the same thing as renal nowadays. But anyway, it's supposed to be a calculus of discrete quantities or assignable proportions. And I haven't been able to look at the document that relates to that. But I have been able to look at the appendix document, which is just a copy of Berkeley's Analyst. Berkeley's anti-calculus work, where he is critical of things like geometers not taking seriously that assignable extension or experienceable extension is what they should be thinking about equally. So you've got a nice note that connects the two, and so it's a nice way of me thinking about what in the next century a cutting edge mathematician was thinking should be done in response to Berkeley, and I guess it sheds an interesting light on how it was received by at least one figure.
And so what you've got there is you've got someone who's this is Alexander Burns in the appendix to his, he's got notes about what he makes of what Berkeley had said.
So Oliver Byrne seems to be trying to design a calculus for...
precisely for this Berkeleyan project.
Certainly one that responds to the demand that we don't treat finite extensions as infinitely divisible in all cases as though that's the nature of extension. So he has appended a copy, one of his original copies of The Analyst, with a little note explaining what he takes himself to be doing with the trinal calculus.
Hey, great.
So I haven't seen any of the workings on the calculus itself, but it's just a very cool thing to be in a position to look at.
Yeah, totally. Oh, that's super good. So When you set out to do this postdoc, when you proposed to do it and obviously got it accepted, what was it you told them you were going to be doing?
So I pitched to do, like, in terms of writing and publications, to write a book 1 year and then to do 3 papers in the other year.
Cool. Okay.
I ended up swapping around the order. So I got, you know, advice that publishing the papers would make it more likely that you get a good publisher for a book.
Yeah.
But the book is supposed to be on Berkeley's philosophy in the 1730s. So that's... the period he's really famous for is between 1709 and 1713, which is where you have all the immaterialism and the theory of vision stuff.
Yeah.
So in the 1730s, that's where you have The Analyst, which is his work on calculus, Alciphron, which is his big dialogue on, I guess, like Christian apologetics. Mm-hmm. It's a punchy read. kind of. And then like The Querist, which is his pretty problematic political treatise, which is an interesting book, for literary reasons, that it only consists of questions.
Hey,
so
wow.
It's big. It's a lot of questions.
I don't know. So I'm aware of other books that only consist of questions, like more recent ones, sort of Ulippian fiction. So what's there's one which is called The Interrogative Mode. It's a great read. I mean, it's sort of...
And is it like an academic thing or a kind
no,
of like
No,
a literary?
It's always sort of like, yeah, it's literary, but you get a bit... you get caught up in the rhythm of the questions, which all kind of... They're all quite short and single sentences, and there'll be hundreds on each page, but you kind of start feeling like you're detecting a narrative through the questions, as if you can imagine a world behind the questions, which they're sort of trying to make sense of. And then that sort of falls apart and you realize it's just a load of questions again. But The Querist, I take it, is probably questions about a particular thing.
Well, I think that like that there's a decent, like, well, I think the trajectory is probably reasonably well explained by, so the Royal Society had been, I think, like, issued a kind of directive that people who were writing about experimental content, so people coming back from like trips collecting specimens and stuff, would append to the back of the kind of catalogues of those works and stuff a set of philosophical questions that would be generated by consideration of those objects and specimens. And so you even see when Newton in the Optics, there's kind of the clinical optical stuff in the main body of the book, but he has a big set of queries at the back, which far exceed the philosophy that you might expect to follow from just consideration of optics.
Yeah.
But then Berkeley seems to do it as well. In The Analyst, he's got the calculus criticism, but then all these kind of metaphysical questions about, you know, metaphysics of mathematics and stuff at the back. So it looks like he's just taken that to like its logical end and just had a whole book
just
full
of questions.
I guess, I mean, most of these questions you feel like the answer is yes. So it has the kind of rhetorical style of, wouldn't it be better if we did such and such?
Yeah,
I think like in most of the cases you can
like, feel yourself,
it seems like he's saying
as if he's trying to persuade you that way. Right, okay.
Yeah.
Hey, that's kind of cool. That's super. Wait, so you've got a focus on that period. Is there something particular about that period you want to be drawing out?
Yeah, well, it's the period that follows his coming back from America. So he'd gone to America to set up a school in Bermuda, which was going to, well, like a college, I suppose, to train, was kind of like a sort of, I guess for the time it would have been quite a modern imperial project, but the idea was to try and train Native Americans alongside sort of planted peoples. Mm-hmm. And I guess it like the project of extending sort of Christianity and Western learning in, you know, in the Western direction.
Mm.
So because of stuff to do with like, bad map making seems to be like Bermuda was just a lot further away from the coast than I think people thought. So I think by the time he got out there, he was surprised and tired.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but then he'd had all this money that had been given, like including a royal sort of stipend for it. And then he wanted to move it to Rhode Island, which is where he was based at that time. But then I think there's a kind of whisper campaign of like, oh, he's moving the college. And, you know, suddenly the whole thing falls apart. So I think he definitely is returning from America with a kind of a plan to try and do the kind of thing with his philosophy that he was trying to do with that project, which is sort of rescue his preferred notion of Christianity in Europe. So the first work he publishes then is this work of apologetics, where he's trying to make what I think is a very pragmatist case for religious belief. Mm. Then he's criticizing calculus, but in this kind of really complicated way, where what he's really trying to say is people who really like science and mathematics but think religion is illogical should pay attention to this illogical aspect of mathematics and see how even, you know, very successful pieces of mathematics seem to fail certain kinds of logical exam. And therefore, shouldn't we chill out a bit about whether the Trinity is you know, such a logical paradox, or whether grace is so ineffable.
And your interest in that is primarily about the mathematics and not so much about the theology, I take it.
I guess, I mean, it started being interested. I thought I would do my PhD on infinitesimals and their changing understanding over time. And I'm still really interested in that. Like, I really like comparing arguments back then to things, like non-standard analysis these days or more recent developments. But I do think it's a really interesting example of somebody doing really powerful ad hominem rhetoric. So what he seems to be doing is this kind of parallel argument in which, so he's often read as just being critical of calculus because it's illogical, but I think what's going on is much more complicated. It's kind of an internal argument about, you know, you can't be a person who both rejects religion or organized religion on the basis of it having problematic logical concepts and also like this new maths.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, and I think, you know, we can think in different ways about what he ultimately thought about mathematics. I tend to think about this quite differently from the way most people who think about Berkeley on mathematics think about it.
Yeah.
But it is a really interesting example of somebody who was very competent in a formal discipline, being able to use that competence to kind of leverage a parity of reason argument for...
That's super cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's just very... The rhetoric around all the stuff is really impressive. And it's a time when people are writing a lot of interesting kind of satire letters, exchanges
it's
over
a very clever
stuff.
Way of communicating some complicated points. That makes him sound, and maybe I'm just showing my kind of naivety, but that makes him sound incredibly modern in a way that so I immediately think of that as you're saying that. I'm thinking of how there are people who are doing stuff in what you could call naturalized approaches to philosophy of mathematics these days, who I guess partly influenced by sort of naturalism in mathematics of that tradition of Penelope Maddy, but also influenced by what sort of science and technology, sociology of science and technology studies and the sociology of science movement, that have said, instead of philosophers having this kind of a priori conception of how mathematics is done, which is just like philosophers sitting in armchairs going, oh, I wonder how people do mathematics, and not even crossing the road and speaking to the people in the maths
completely
department.
Yeah.
If we started being a bit more like anthropologists of knowledge or sociologists of knowledge in that way that sort of that tradition have developed from the strong school or the strong program or whatever, if we actually go and spend some time around mathematicians and see what they actually do, we'll realize their standards are nothing like the ones we imagine they are. And I think there's a bunch of people who, I mean, there's sort of movement around that with Brendan Larvor, who's at Hertfordshire. He has this sort of project on notions of rigorous proof in mathematics, where he says everybody thinks that the way that you do things in maths is give a rigorous proof that can somehow be shown in some sort of first order logic or something, but no mathematician actually ever does that. We've got this conception of what mathematical proof is like, and then there's the actual messy business of giving mathematical proofs.
All these kind of different conceptions of like legitimacy in proofs,
right.
So there's kind of rigor, there's elegance these days, there's like lots of different things that seem to play into like what mathematicians prefer as proofs. I mean, it's computer assisted proofs, there's all this kind of
those questions. And so that sort of slightly more naturalistic approach to how is mathematics done, which says, well, let's pay attention to how mathematics is done instead of imagining it from a sort of philosophical armchair.
It's a really nice period to study philosophy of mathematics, because so many of the key philosophers are mathematicians. And also even the ones that are not practicing mathematicians often have, you know, very significant relationships to one. So like one example would be Francis Hutcheson has this correspondence with Colin McLaren.
Cool.
And, you know, this is something I only discovered this year, but Hutcheson is writing to McLaren. McLaren famously wrote a treatise on fluxions, which was the book that did the longest form attempt at rescuing Newton's fluxions from criticisms like Berkeley's. But Hutcheson is writing from Ireland to McLaren saying, like, you've got to get this book out, man. Berkeley's, you know, followers are growing bolder every day.
Nice.
But there is this kind of, you know, there's interaction.
A sort of competitive, human, messy stuff, right?
Yeah, and I think, like, Paolo Mancozzi has written about this as well, like, that it just is a really good period for that. And, like, so someone like Berkeley just has incredible mathematical literacy. So whether it's, like, Nieuwentet and Kluver, so these kind of obscure, like, Dutch mathematicians, or, like, looking at what's going on in the Acta Eruditorum, which is, like, Leibniz's journal network, or Journal de Scavons, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, but he just seems to be really pretty much up to speed on at least the mathematics of like 5 to 10 years ago, which is not something we can say now
totally
of
not.
Most philosophers who would want to get involved in mathematics.
Well, so that's a good question for me to ask you then. So how have you got involved in philosophy of mathematics, and And this, do you have a background in maths? Is that your way into it?
No, so my undergrad was in English Lit.
Hey, cool.
Yeah, so it's been quite a journey.
Wow. So wait, what were you into in English Lit? What was your, were you like a Shakespeare person or like a...
I don't know. I liked, I'm really obsessed with Flann O'Brien at the moment. So I've always liked writing that is funny and I really like Irish writing in general. So,
okay, yeah.
I think it is
well,
a really...
we call it English Lit anyway, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. well, I guess like Irish Lit, you know, in Irish is different kettle of fish, but, you know, also good. And Flann O'Brien, a good man for both, both languages. But yeah, I guess I just did what I was told. I mean, I was not a very diligent or focused undergraduate student. So I liked most things I was reading. Something like Beowulf and stuff I found pretty hard work.
But I mean, the kind of work that actually is probably quite useful to you now. So acts of
laborious.
Well, yeah, laborious and like and kind of quite hard reading and it requires a kind of degree of scholarship that maybe other things that you might read in a literature course might not, I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely maybe discovered like an affection for things like dictionary searching and trying to understand like the contextual use of words. So like I remember I did it like a course that was fully based on Paradise Lost by Milton, where it was a really nice part of it, like, you know, sitting down and trying to figure how people, you know, in that period would have used the word. So like even now, actually in my early modern philosophy stuff, I'm always looking at like early modern lexicon and like Dr. Johnson's dictionary. So you can go and look up what is meant by people or what
how they're using it at the time. Right. Okay.
And it could be really helpful as well.
How do you go from English Lit to looking at infinitesimals?
So I really don't. So I was studying English and French as an undergrad, and then I was doing very terribly in French, partly because you just can't cram a language, and that was the only way I wanted to be. Well, you can't cram a foreign language anyway.
Like we say this to our logic students every year.
Say it to our logic students as well. Like this is not easy, quick.
Before.
It really is like, you know, you wouldn't attack the Turkish exam, you know, the Turkish exam in 1 week.
No, I'll just do it. I'll do it tonight. I'll just read all of the things I need to know. Like, yeah, that's never going
to
happen.
Yeah,
like,
I really think it's such an important message that you need to almost be tearful at the front of the like the lecture hall while giving it, just like, you don't know, okay, how bad this will be if you leave it late. But so I did a master's where I did like a mixture. Oh, sorry, I should say I got into philosophy in the last year of my undergrad because I needed to switch out of French because it was threatening.
And they let you in.
It was the only thing you could get into without having done first and second year was philosophy.
So and you've like, done no philosophy at all and now you can take your final year in
third year philosophy. Here we go. Crazy. So and I was basically like picking subjects on the basis of which words I recognized. Excellent. So like the fact that I know more about philosophy of language and logic now and not hermeneutics and deconstruction has a pretty obvious linguistic story. I did a philosophy of language module. The main way I remember it becoming something more serious, I did Maria Bagramian's philosophy of language module. And then she called me in because I'd done what she thought was a very good essay. And she said, you should go on and do more of this. And I was at that point in my life where I really just wanted someone to make a decision for me about what I was going to do next. So just, did what she said and went and did a master's. And then I think the interest in it, it was Berkeley on calculus that initially got me interested. But then I spent some time thinking about stuff about like the axiom of choice and Zermelo Fraenkel. Set theory, and the beginning of set theory. So it's always been kind of historical philosophy of maths I'm more interested in and like very contextually focused. So like what are the people who are making the arguments motivated by, you know, even if it's a mathematical thing they're motivated by, it really interests me. And I think having learned all of this stuff historically, like learning about calculus for me literally started with like Calculus for the Humanities book, where it took you all the way from ancient, you know, ancient mathematicians all the way through the kind of convergence through like Barrow and Wallace and people or Cavalieri, like people beginning to do things that are relevant to calculus right until I got to calculus. And so while I don't think I'm like a perfect interpreter of the stuff, having learned it historically means, you know, I feel like I have a good grasp at least of the kind of significance of developments as they occur and why people are so excited about various things.
Yeah, I mean, I think my standing in bits of philosophy and maths always makes me feel really inadequate because I just feel like I'm not a mathematician. I don't know the stuff. I haven't taken maths courses. So my education in that area is sort of self-taught. And then, you know, when people, there's normally like people who are autodidacts or whatever, people who've like just had to learn things by their own bootstraps, you know, when they sometimes say a word out loud and they pronounce it wrong because they've never heard anyone say it.
Yeah.
Because they've just read it a lot and then they kind of finally say it to someone else and people are like, wow, you're saying that really weirdly. I feel like I'm always doing that in some areas of philosophy of science and philosophy of mathematics. Not with the words so much as...
Like notation, right? So how do you describe integrals or how do you read out certain... Yeah, no, I completely hear you. I will have to look up people doing that. And I certainly have in the past.
And that's why YouTube's amazing, right? Because you can just see someone and you just want to hear the word they say. Like, how are you saying that thing? Like,
But it is, I do think, I mean, I agree that I find it very intimidating a lot of the time. And I don't think I'm a real natural mathematics person. I managed to do higher level in school, but I needed a lot of help. And it was definitely the subject that took up the most time. And it was kind of only as a product of my mum saying I sort of had to keep up higher level for that.
Do more. Yeah.
Just because it kept, you know, options open that other stuff didn't for university. But I think because I'm not a natural at it, I do find I have to work really hard to understand it. I do think that helps philosophically because very often it causes me to never really gloss over the underpinnings of things.
No, that's good, right? So you want to see every step along the way and see why is this thing doing the thing it's supposed to be doing.
And I hope it helps me teach it as well in that, like, I know it's often a problem with logic lecturing that, like, the people who end up lecturing logic find logic so natural that it's really difficult for them to imagine what it's like not to understand material implications or something like this. Totally. But I really understand how long it took because it is not natural for me. So I do feel like it definitely helps me teaching those subjects because I have a decent sense of how unnatural this stuff can be and, you know, why you might not be convinced of things or why you sometimes just have to learn things until they settle into your
And it's interesting, maybe that's a feature that we do quite a lot in philosophy anyway in other areas. So we were talking earlier about how we'll look at arguments that just look patently crazy in some philosophical work, right? And then getting some students to see that we are looking at crazy arguments, they do look crazy, and your job is not to just fall for it, but is just to dig out what the argument really is and then be critical of it. Because I think we're trying to encourage that sense of curiosity that we want people to go, how is this supposed to work? What are the steps supposed to be? I kind of feel like, if you're going to be a good teacher in any area, and I think that's logic's a great example, you want to be able to do that. Like, okay, why do we care about this? Is everyone following? Do you get the steps that go through it? I mean, in a sense, that brings out some of the frustration I feel around teaching in general, which is how we package things into small little units, and then students are increasingly taught to expect that they're going to get it at the end of that, you know, 1 hour of lectures and 1 hour of tutorials. And I keep thinking, like, no one should expect that you're going to get it just from that engagement. The way you're going to get it is by, just like you do with learning French or learning the violin, right, is to go and spend hours working at it
and talk to somebody about it for a while and try and see if you agree on, like, what the best way to summarize it is. I definitely feel like it is one of the reasons. I mean, I think increasingly as people teaching philosophy, we have to be aware of things that people in university are going through that it's very hard for certain people because of, like, increasing rates of anxiety and all sorts of stuff to be the natural seminar speakers that we would all like them to be. I mean, I don't think I said a word in undergrad seminars in philosophy. I just was so afraid of embarrassing myself all the time but it just gets harder and harder. That's what I'm always trying to say to our first year students, like, you should start trying to get involved if you can and if you feel comfortable, you know, when the material is still reasonably easy, because it's a great habit to develop, just being able to ask questions.
How does it affect you with the kind of adjunct lifestyle that you've had for the last few years? Now you've got 2 years in a single place. That's pretty good. But that
I'll never get me out of that office.
Leave me in the library. But how is it working for you in terms of having other people around? How much do, like you say, sometimes being able to talk over something with another person is a really useful thing. So you might think, actually, one of the reasons that some philosophy departments in the UK are so successful at making or getting good graduate students into good places and having, you know, healthy relations between people is because they're all able to talk. There's enough of them that they can have decent conversations. But when you're adjunct, you're flying from one place for a few months to another place for a few months. Maybe you don't really get to see people, but maybe you don't get the same kind of network of people who are going to be reading your stuff, or do you just have to build that on the outside? I mean, how do you do it?
It's all you say. And then additionally, it's like, you know, certain places are just more specialized in certain things. So, like, the real luxury of being where I am now is that there are, like, at least 4 people working on Barclay, which is just not the case.
And are they nice anywhere people?
Else. They're lovely people. Okay. I mean, shout out to the Barclay posse. But, you know, you've got 2 sort of senior PhD students and, you know, a professor. And it just, and then, you know, you've got sort of, you know, Jim Devine is, you know, not a Barclayan, but interested in Barclay. You've got this, you know, community of people who take what he has to say seriously and kind of know what he's doing. So that is really nice.
But in a sense, that's a recent addition to your life, that before this, you've been floating between places where you maybe don't have that on tap, right?
Well, just certainly for the last year and a half where I haven't had a permanent, you know, academic home, that has been the case. And then, you know, you love your spouse enough not to try this out on them if they're not in the same field as you are.
Yeah,
I definitely feel it's a lovely thing to be able to discuss work in a non-threatening environment. Like, I have to say, and on a kind of gendered point, I always feel, because I'm a woman in a field, especially when I'm in a sort of philosophy of mathematics context, but even in history of philosophy as well, and actually especially in history of mathematics, which is pretty bad.
Quite unique.
Yeah. That I do feel like I don't really have the luxury of asking clarificatory questions. So feel like if you're going to be the only woman who speaks in a room, it takes a lot of confidence to sort of ask a question which betrays that you don't understand. So I feel is one real disadvantage of not having better representation. Yeah. And difference is that if you really stand out as, you just sort of feel like a representative of your gender in a way where what you really would be aching to say is like, I have no idea what you were talking about for the second five of those, you know, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Can you just run through, you know, that bit again?
Just give me that one bit again.
But it's hard not to feel like you're letting the side down a bit or that you're, you know,
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that we try and get students to do all the time. We're always trying to encourage them to say, is just like, if you don't understand something, ask about it, because you know, there's no stupid questions. We're going to work through things so that everyone gets there. But you're right, I can see that that's going to be a scene where there's a kind of expectation that, I mean, do you think people, I mean, including the gendered aspect, do you think everyone is feeling the need to keep up appearances? Is that a zone where is there quite a lot of ego?
So I think it definitely is like a misplaced way of thinking about it that I have, but I think there's the kind of dual thing of, you know, there's like letting yourself down or feeling like, not letting yourself down, but feeling like you're, it takes a lot of confidence to show that you don't understand something. And it's good confidence. You should be able to do it, but I certainly don't always have it all the time. But then there's this kind of additional element. And I presume it, you know, is that times 10 for people who are underrepresented on more axes than, you know, the one that I just am, that you feel like you are representing more than just yourself in certain academic interactions. So in a case where you are the only woman in the room, it's easy to feel like you speak for womanhood when you express a certain confusion or you. So
do you find that you speak on, you feel that way when you're speaking with people who are more in a maths background, that you're the philosopher in the room? Do you feel like you're somehow representing philosophers as well?
I think it's easier when it's not a field in which you're supposed to be an expert. So I definitely find it easier. I've started doing a lot of work in history of mathematics, which, you know, it's not something I'm trained in, but it's so close to the topic of my research that it just makes sense to be trying to train up and get involved and give papers and publish in that field too. But it's much easier for me at those conferences to say, you know, philosopher here, I'm just wondering, and you know, when there is the kind of explicit concession that you're not an expert in this field, it's very easy to hide behind, you know, your sort of presumption that they respect you as being an expert in something else, but just curious to learn in this. So I definitely think it's harder when it's a, you know, I would, it's harder when I know I'm expected to know. Or
And how's that working out? How's that come about, that you're working more with the kind of history of, I mean, obviously I can see the links, but you're actually doing, you're writing with people, what, like collaboratively, or in the history of mathematics, in mathematics?
Well, so I mean, there's just this really nice pair of exchanges of letters that kind of really relate to the research I'd done on Berkeley on calculus. So there's all of the exchanges over the priority debate, which is the fight between Newton and Leibniz, and like, to a greater extent, their respective academic communities about, you know, who can have the claim of having really invented / discovered it, depending on your philosophy.
The most important thing, who came first.
Right? And they behave appallingly, not the two guys specifically, but like John Keel on Newton's behalf, and the Bernoulli brothers are just like throwing all sorts of, you know, bizarre accusations around. And it's just like a really exciting thing to read, like some of the greatest minds in history just be absolute dopes.
Just intemperate, right, okay.
And then there's the responses to Berkeley's criticism of the calculus. So you get lots of people, including sort of devoted Newtonians, kind of defending Newton's honor and suggesting that Berkeley was saying a little bit more than he was saying. But Berkeley is so horribly behaved in these exchanges, like the extent to which he is nasty to the people he's dealing with, it's really like a thing of, I mean, it's hard not to admire, you know, how, in the same way that you might really enjoy, like, I really enjoy watching my sister be mean to boys. It's kind of like that feeling. So because of that, like, it's taken me more into the kind of pamphlet exchanges and the kind of satirical culture of the period. And I have to say, I absolutely love reading that stuff.
Totally.
And it is nice that I have, because I have, I guess, like theoretical expertise in the kind of details of the stuff that they're fighting about, I feel like it's perfectly natural for me to start trying to train up in being a more respectable historian in my approach to it.
Right. And so we're familiar with this kind of stuff now. I mean, a couple of examples spring to mind. One would be, you know, so you know how, and I was about to say the second one, but the first one I was thinking of was, you know how when someone writes a really cutting review of a book in philosophy and everyone absolutely loves that review because it's so intemperate and cutting. And like, I can think of examples from like 30 years ago, sort of two people who reviewed each other's books.
It's McGinn and Hendrick.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, the sort of tit for tat kind of like takedowns.
There was a great one recently on that book on Disgust. Do you remember that?
Right. So I was thinking of that one more recently, which is just, you know, I mean, to take down Colin McGinn now seems like there's a kind of activity that people do, almost like a blood sport. But I guess a lot of people think he deserves it because he's Colin McGinn. But that's the other one I was thinking of, which we're familiar with this now, which is just Facebook and Twitter and trolling and people taking each other down and trying out their wit on each other for the gallery, right? Because you know there are going to be other people out there who are going to enjoy seeing. I mean, there's a part of this which is just terribly badly behaved, right? And our enjoyment of it is not without problem. It's not unproblematic, right?
Yeah.
In some of these cases.
Oh, like one of the ones that. I wrote a popular article about this recently where I'm claiming that Barclay, you know, should be understood as giving a kind of masterclass in trolling.
Awesome.
And it's on this mathematician called Jacob Walton, who was a kind of Dublin guy. We don't really know much about him except that he left £4,000 to his two house servants, which is very interesting in its own right.
Right, that's all we know.
Yeah.
And that Barclay laid into him.
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, it's really humiliating the way he sort of, he does this kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So basically he treats this guy's defense of Newton's calculus as though the only way to understand how bad it is to see that this guy is actually secretly trying to sabotage Newton by bumbling public defenses of him.
Wow.
So what Barclay does is like accuses him of being like a secret Newtonian saboteur whose way of humiliating Newton is like getting into the public arena and like making kind of Newtonian arguments in a really stupid way. So like you can imagine how mean that is to like step out into the arena of letters to defend your intellectual icon and then have somebody like
accuse
say,
you of
like, oh, at first I just thought you were a dope, but now I see that the only explanation for how terrible your arguments are is that you must be trying to destroy your recently dead hero's reputation. Wow. So, I mean, it definitely is.
Cutting. Yeah.
Yeah. And because, I mean, I was saying this to you earlier, because of the sort of cheapness and new availability of printing, you get these like exchanges happening really quickly and lots of people weighing in. And I guess you have a broader community of readers. So like with us talking about those mean philosophers reviewing each other book thing, I mean, it's really only us. I mean, I don't know anyone else in my life that's not in academic philosophy that has heard of any of that.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas like then, and I guess it's something you see in like Enlightenment philosophy in general, you've got much more of a sense that like the philosophy of the time and like the letters culture of the time is more available to, you know, obviously what is still a subset of of communities where there's enormous poverty outside of a certain sort of central group, but still within the kind of educated classes that have
it's
a bit
not
of
just
money,
limited to,
everyone is kind of enjoying this stuff.
Yeah,
and same
yeah.
with the kind of satire and cartooning stuff happening in early modern
and London. You feel like Barclay is playing to the gallery? He is actually just doing this kind of he's doing it for the culture war? Like,
I mean, he definitely, I guess it's really hard to say.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, he definitely enjoys, you know, there's instances of him having a friend secretly publish a mean poem about one of these guys in a journal in London. So there's a sense that, you know, there's elements of it that are, you know, I mean, in this poem also he calls the guy, you know, a grumpy, choleric fellow and then like describes himself as the jolly prelate.
Okay.
So like, you know, there is sort of a slightly more seedy element, but I don't know. I think he genuinely, I mean, he doesn't really argue for stuff that he doesn't feel, I don't think.
Right.
But and he did see this strange relationship between religious infidelity and a kind of creeping scientism and mathematical, logical obsessivism. So the two are kind of weirdly conflated for him in a way that's hard to unpack, in a way that means he does seem to think he has like the verve of God on his side while he argues against these people.
Right.
Because he sees it as part of this project of like...
Of being a bishop.
Yeah, or like, it's, you know, legitimizing religion.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Right. So it's okay to be a little bit callous and a bit dismissive of people who aren't really there because, you know, you've got a bigger project for their souls.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he is saying in that later work, like, you know, wouldn't it be, you know, shouldn't we consider that certain kinds of heretic should be punished legally and, you know, criminally in the same way that people who are guilty of treason against the king are. So, you know, the quite radical stuff about people who are not toeing the line. And these are people who are still saying that they're religious, but just proposing slightly non-standard changes to religious doctrine. So like the free thinkers are the people he has in mind. So like Toland, Collins.
And so I just don't know enough Berkeley to kind of know like the canon of his works, but I take it that he, like most philosophers, probably changed his mind about quite a few things over the course of his work, right? That's what we do, because we put out pretty bold theories and then we think about them more and other people tell us that maybe that doesn't work or whatever. And so we tweak them and improve them. But of course, if you're going to go around telling people that they should be executed, or that you should somehow treat them really badly because they've got the wrong beliefs in some areas, that makes it quite hard for you to change your mind. I mean, is that something? Is there a tension there in his work? Do you see him changing his mind? Is he pretty consistent?
I don't see many examples of Berkeley saying, "I'll tell you, I've really changed what I think about this." So, I mean, there's a very clear example where he did do it, but it's only in the very earliest stuff. So he seems committed to a Lockean theory of meaning in his very, very, very earliest works. And that's really almost like pre the new theory of vision. So pre the first famous book, by which time the sort of year or two after, it seems he's already got a more subtle kind of use focused theory of meaning.
Good.
So that's one clear example.
But that's the immature versus the mature, as it were.
Yeah, right, okay. But then there is a real sea change in the very last work. Mm. So it's not a work I'm an expert on, so I wouldn't be able to tell you in huge detail. But it was, I think, the work that sold the best, you know, near his lifetime. And it's mostly about tar water. Do you know about this book?
No, I've heard that, but I literally heard about this last week. I have no idea. He thinks tar water is somehow good for health. Is that the view?
Yeah, thinks it very strongly. And there are definitely some in the Berkeley community who still subscribe to this.
And they drink tar water.
I mean, hello to Brian Glennie, who brought me over some tar water soap.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so I've been washing my face with it, and my husband tells me I smell like a shipyard.
Oh, Jesus.
But yeah, so it's basically this kind of pine tar that you mix into a kind of liquor or like a kind of strong medicine.
Okay.
And he thinks you should drink it as strong as you can hack it and drink it all day long. And he thinks it's kind of a panacea or a panacea. That's one of those words I read more than I know how it's said.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, 2/3 of that book, I think, is like mostly about tar water. And then the last third there's a lot of disagreement in the scholarship about how to interpret it. Like, two of the biggest Berkeley scholars, like, one sees it as completely continuous with the natural trajectory of Berkeley's philosophical project, and then the other sees it as a really embarrassing thing that, you know, who knows what to say about this crazy book he wrote in the end. He seems to accept things like maybe abstract ideas seem to be there. There's a real Platonist energy to it, which definitely is very hard to find in the earlier works. And I mean, there definitely is the sense that with that last big work, he definitely has changed his mind, or at least his philosophy has really evolved very far away from where it was pretty close together.
It's not
in the
just a weird exercise in irony or something. It's not kind of like this.
No,
this
I mean,
is, this is what I think. You know, when you see people throwing sort of slings that across the supposed analytic continental divide, where people take the piss out of each other's work. And you can imagine someone. Yeah, and then you can imagine someone writing those kind of satirical. What's that famous case? The Sokol hoax, right?
This is how you write your nonsense,
right? That kind of nonsense.
Yeah,
it's not that.
Because I mean, it would be weird to do that, especially where he's really putting forward his most sincere case for tar water, which is the thing that he's most focused on promoting at that point. Right. So it would be very weird of him to put
Was he trying to make money out of it?
He genuinely believed. I mean, he's telling all of his closest friends and correspondents. So like he's heard it's curing asthma. He's heard it's really helping with very serious ailments. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, there is a question about, like, you know, how much tar water can you drink in a way that might not impact your philosophical thinking? I mean, could you just consume so much of this stuff that it started to change your views? I don't know what kind of a.
But okay, I, like, If we've got Barclay down as like a kind of proto internet troll who's taking advantage of the new medium of communication, which isn't Twitter, but it's pamphlets, and he's a go-to guy for writing stuff that everybody's kind of subscribing to, it does kind of make sense that he would start proselytizing about something with like health benefits. And you know, because it goes with the brand, right? You've got to have a diverse portfolio of things that you're shilling for.
To be fair to Barclay, who I am frequently less than fair to, I think, yeah, compared to most people who work on him, I mean, I do think there is a real sincerity in all the stuff that he that he is doing. So I mean, even when he's doing the kind of more satirical nasty stuff, he does seem to be seeing himself as on this kind of divine, you know, mission. He does interesting kind of other satire bits. So he has like a sort of sci-fi thing he writes about a journey to the pineal gland. So he imagines that he can snort a special snuff that will allow him to go into the Cartesian mind of his ideological opponents. So there definitely is like a more playful sense of the writing. But I do think if you're thinking about the late stuff, he definitely thought tar water cured people, and he definitely seems to have changed his views, at least in some way.
Wow. Well, this has been excellent. it's really good to speak to you about what you're up to. Let me thank you for doing this.
You're very welcome. Thank you for doing this also.
Okay, so that's a chance to wrap up another episode of Generous Questions. My thanks to Claire Moriarty for being such a great person, for coming to Queen's and for speaking to our undergraduates, and for talking to me about all these crazy things like snorting a special snuff to be able to get some deep insights about philosophy. Shortly after we recorded this, Claire sent me some photos from the archives down in Trinity. She'd got hold of the illustrated calculus by Oliver Byrne, and I'll put some photos of that on our website. So that's generousquestions.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Joe Morrison. You can find Claire on Twitter at Quite Claire. That's all one word, Quite, C-L-A-R-E. I hope you'll join us on a future episode, and do send in any comments you've got. Do get in touch. It's lovely to hear from you. Any thoughts, any reactions, any questions, happy to field them. Happy to hear more from you. Keep in touch. Many thanks. Bye-bye.